from 90.1 WFYI Public Radio. Welcome to The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you, and by support from the Central Indiana Community Foundation, the Indiana Arts Commission, a state agency, and by the National Endowment for the Arts, a federal agency.
Hello and welcome to The Art of the Matter. I'm Travis DiNicola. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Baselli Wallrab Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Al Studios at alstudios.com.
And I'm Sharon Gamble.
And today is basically an all-Sharon show.
Hey, that's right. Today I'll take you on journeys that start with King Tut, then the journey jumps to Midwest art and ends with, are you ready, some bent objects. Stay tuned, and it will all make sense.
Excellent. And, of course, we'll have our arts calendar that we call
What'll We Do? All this and more right after the latest news from NPR.
There's something fascinating about King Tut. And a new exhibition opening this weekend at the Children's Museum of Indianapolis will give us a chance to find out more about this mysterious monarch. Jeff Patchen, president and CEO of the museum, came by to talk with Sharon Gamble about Tutankhamun, the Golden King, and the Great Pharaohs, and the series of events that led to the museum snagging this high-profile show.
Okay, I have to first of all say congratulations. What a coup it is to get this exhibit.
Well, sure. Thank you very much. We're very excited, and it comes as a result of an interesting relationship with the First Lady of Egypt, Mrs. Suzanne Mubarak, and
How did that happen?
And our work with Dr. Zahi Hawass. Well, about 5 years ago, we started a project called National Geographic Maps, Tools for Adventure. It was a traveling exhibit we did with National Geographic, and we featured half a dozen National Geographic explorers, of which Dr. Zahi Hawass, the chair of the Supreme Council of Antiquities in Egypt, was featured. And he invited us to Egypt to film him at one of his excavation sites, and he said the his agreeing to be on a video was contingent on us agreeing to be part of a critique for new exhibits and architecture for the new Suzanne Mubarak Children's Museum, and would we agree to meet with Her Excellency, Mrs. Mubarak, for a brief meeting to critique the exhibits.
Had you said yes before the question was out?
Exactly.
I mean, it
was so exciting. And so we had it was three staff, and this goes back almost 5 years. And we had this wonderful meeting, and at the end of the meeting, we were asked if we would actually, Dr. Hawass was very brave, actually cunning, to suggest that perhaps the Children's Museum of Indianapolis would be willing to design the exhibitry for this new Children's Museum in Cairo for Mrs. Mubarak. And he asked us in front of Mrs. Mubarak with kind of no discussion about how we might work this arrangement out. But again, what can you say to a First Lady who is passionate about libraries, passionate about museums and children and women's issues in the Middle East? And so we said yes and kind of worried about the details later.
Sure.
And we're so blessed that the thank you from Mrs. Mubarak and from Dr. Hawass and the Supreme Council is really to have King Tut here for 4 months when it was scheduled to go to much larger cities at a extreme cost that we could never afford here in Indianapolis. So that's what makes it
what
so special to the Children's Museum.
What a fabulous backstory. Right place, right time.
Absolutely.
And you know, but not to discredit the world's largest children's museum. I mean, I know that you get calls every week, several times a week, from people saying, we're thinking about starting a children's museum in our city. Can you guide us?
We get a lot of those.
Yeah.
We've done some work in Dubai with Children's City. We've done work with the Guangzhou Children's Museum and Children's Palace in Guangzhou, China, and work in Amsterdam, and work for Queen Rania of Jordan. So
wow.
There's lots of interest in the Middle East for doing more for children and more for education.
How do you account for that?
I don't know. It's this wonderful group of first ladies. I mean, from Queen Rania to Princess Haya in Dubai to Mrs. Mubarak. They're extraordinary women who are really concerned about future generations, their children and their grandchildren, living in a peaceful world and living in a place where there are libraries and museums and rich culture.
What a great legacy. What a wonderful feather in the cap of the Children's Museum and of you as its leader.
Well, thank you.
For that matter. So speaking of leaders, King Tut, everybody knows about King Tut's stuff. Fewer people know about King Tut's reign and the structure of government and the good things that he did for his people. But there's, I remember as a kid in the 1970s when the first King Tut exhibit came to the United States.
It did.
People stood in line for hours for tickets, and there was this absolute fascination. Why do you think
that is? Well, I think the mystery is still there. The mystery, there's so much mystery around Egypt and the pyramids and the tombs and all of that. But certainly, so many people tell the story of waiting in line in 1976 mm-hmm. in Chicago, New York, L.A. That was the only time that the mask ever traveled mm-hmm. out of Egypt. And, of course, the mask remains in Egypt. And these two exhibitions, one that was in Chicago a couple years ago, Fort Lauderdale, is finishing in Dallas. And now the second one, the Golden King and the Great Pharaoh's exhibition, really focuses more on pharaonic life and the relationship of Tut to other pharaohs. But, of course, at the end of the exhibit, it's still that mystery of the boy, this notion of a boy king and this notion of how did he die and trying to solve that mystery.
The people will have the chance to bring children from grade school, middle school, high school. There are education programs targeting different age levels. What do you think... will be is there an optimum age for someone to see this exhibition?
Well, I don't think so. I think it's for all, it's really for kids and adults of all ages. And we've developed a unit of study that is free, will be free online. Also professional development institutes for teachers this summer, but the units are online and they tie to national standards and state standards. So for teachers that are involved in social studies, language, arts, even in science, this is a great unit of, in history, it's a great unit of study. So it'll appeal to school groups. And another one of the huge blessings with this exhibit coming is that the Lilly Endowment has provided us with a $2 million grant to support school children from throughout the state and actually some of the surrounding states to come to Tut for free.
Oh my gosh.
Right. And you can go online to the Children's Museum website, and teachers can and principals can. And kind of a shout-out to all of you principals and teachers, because I know this is almost the last week of school, to make your reservations for your preferred time slots, starting in, of course, when kids come back to school through the end of October. But that's a huge gift to the city and to the state of Indiana from the Lilly Endowment to support those school visits.
Now, obviously, with National Geographic's involvement, there's rock solid rigorous education that's happening. Although, if you have kids listening to this, get them away from the radio, because we don't want them to know they're getting educated. We're just going to slip them in for the glorious artifacts and sneak some education in. But kids are going to learn about geography, government.
Obviously, geography, government, the glitz and the gold, and all of the things that were. I mean, so many of the objects that were found in Tut's tomb, which is just incredibly exciting. Kids, like dinosaurs, kids are fascinated with mummies and the whole idea of mummification and this concept of the desire to live forever, which is part of the whole, the tomb building and the mummification and all of that. But we're also opening a 13,000 square foot permanent exhibit called Take Me There that will open at the same time, and it's a changing immersion experience, cultural immersion experience, that will change cultures every 2 to 3 years. And we're opening with modern Egypt. So it will be called Take Me There, Egypt. And you are transported by Egypt Airlines, Egypt Air, and you land in Cairo, and you can change your money from dollars to Egyptian pounds, and you can learn a little bit of Arabic. You can trade in the Egyptian market. You can create works of art. You can learn some calligraphy, about the ecosystem of the Nile, and then you can sign up for a cultural immersion experience where you actually participate in a modern-day traditional Egyptian ceremony called the Sabua, and it's the presentation of a newborn child on the seventh day to the community. And so it's our new cultural immersion space in the museum that used to be called Passport to the World,
mm-hmm.
that will be called Take Me There, and we're coordinating that first country to be Egypt, with obviously King Tut coming. So if you're worried about what to do with the kids when mommy and daddy are looking at the glitz and the gold and all things Tut, just take them downstairs and they'll have this wonderful experience learning about modern day Egypt and the connections to Egypt's past.
What great opportunities. You know, the tomb of King Tut was discovered, was it in the 20s,
1922? Howard Carter.
But there are still mysteries being solved. Modern medical science is helping us to reveal some other things about King Tut. But there are still things that are not known.
Exactly. Dr. Hawass has found the remains of what he believes are the wet nurse of King Tut, far away from the Valley of the Kings in another place. We were so fortunate to be able to visit with a media crew about a month ago and lowered 90 feet down into the base of the Step Pyramid in Giza and Saqqara, and to go down inside that, and there is a huge crypt sarcophagus about 16 feet square, and Dr. Hawass we were able to film that, and it'll be broadcast on special later. But and it's just so exciting that there are still uncovering so many mysteries in China. In Egypt.
We were just talking about
country,
passport to the world.
I know.
That's where we're going next.
After Egypt, actually, is taking me there, China. So we had a team last week in China beginning to work on that.
That slip reveals something behind the scenes of the Children's Museum in that, like any museum, you're working 5 and 10 and 20 years ahead on what's coming up.
We are.
Your mind has to be in multiple places.
I'm a little embarrassed, but we did have two staff in Beijing and Xi'an because we will actually be, we're working on another exhibit called Treasures of the Earth, and so getting an archaeology exhibit that will replace the What If exhibit, and it'll feature a replica of the part of the tomb of Seti I. You know, we've had an Egyptian tomb in a mummy in the museum forever. But we're going to focus on Seti I because a new entrance to that tomb has been found, and Dr. Hawass is going to allow us to reproduce part of that tomb. And kids there will focus on the restoration. How do you go about restoring a tomb and the painting and all of that? The second section will focus on the Terracotta Warrior Dig in Xi'an. So we've established a relationship with the Terracotta Warrior Institute and Museum in Xi'an, and so we had staff last week in China beginning to work on the Take Me There China exhibit and this Treasures of the Earth exhibit.
Lots of frequent flyer miles being racked up at the
Children's Museum. We're very blessed that the Take Me There exhibit is fully funded. It was an $8 million project, $3 million for capital, and $5 million endowment that will allow us to change cultures without having to go out and do any fundraising in the future as we go forward. In today's economic environment, we're so glad that many of these major projects, which were part of a capital campaign, have come to fruition and are fully funded. We still have about $5 million left to go on our $74 million campaign, which will be tough in this financial environment, but we're blessed that so much has been accomplished and we're looking forward.
Do you have a favorite artifact in the Tut show?
Oh. There is the largest sculpture of Tut found that's coming. That's one of my favorites. But I think the canopic jars, and there is the top of one of the canopic jars, which, of course, carried the portion of the internal organs, and they're made out of alabaster. Mm. And there's one that's coming with this exhibition that is just, I mean, the paint looks like it was painted yesterday on the alabaster. It's just extraordinary.
And is it an animal figure? Is it a...
It is an animal figure.
Yeah. Cool. Well, we'll keep an eye on that, make sure it doesn't go missing.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And the Arts Exhibition International, the production company that produces the exhibit and travels the exhibit, the boxes and containers of all of the exhibit materials have been arriving. And it's pretty exciting around the museum.
Sharon Gamble with Jeff Passion, President and CEO of the Children's Museum of Indianapolis. Tutankhamun, the Golden King and the Great Pharaohs, opens this weekend and features more than 130 treasures from the tomb of the celebrated pharaoh King Tut and additional ancient sites. It runs through October of this year. The exhibition is organized by National Geographic, Arts and Exhibitions International, and AEG Exhibitions, with cooperation from the Egyptian Supreme Council of Antiquities. Visit childrensmuseum.org for details.
You're listening to The Art of the Matter on WFYI 90.1 FM Public Radio.
Rachel Berenson Perry is having an unusually busy spring. She's the fine arts curator for the Indiana State Museum in Indianapolis, and she has recently written two books and curated the new exhibit, Making It in the Midwest, Artists Who Chose to Stay. The exhibit opened last weekend, allowing Rachel a bit of free time to tell Sharon about her new projects and how a job shoeing horses led her to the world of art.
You've had a bit of a soft spot for artists who have stayed here or who've made something of a home base here.
Right. Well, a lot of people now don't realize that actually T.C. Steele and William Forsythe and three other Hoosier artists, J. Otis Adams, Otto Stark, and Richard Gruelle, all studied in Europe except for Richard Gruelle, and when they came back, they made a conscious decision to stay in the Midwest and paint what they knew best, and to really help people from Indiana appreciate the subtle beauty of what we have here instead of going to a more dramatic countryside to paint. And also they wanted to raise their families and live here rather than going to New York City or Philadelphia, where the art scene was much more active.
You know, that was, I don't know that with our modern minds we can fully appreciate what a risk that was, because back then it really was, if you weren't in Europe, you didn't count in some ways, or if you weren't in New York, you didn't count. Although a lot of contemporary artists, visual artists, face the same issue. They feel as though, I feel like I need to move to New York.
And that's one reason why when we were developing the exhibit to go along with the book, which is called T.C. Steele and the Society of Western Artists, 1896 to 1914, and has just come out, just been published by Indiana University Press. But when we wanted to do a tandem exhibit, the museum staff decided that would really be fun to do contemporary artists as well as the historical ones. And so I spend a lot of time choosing the same number of contemporary artists as the number of artists who had started the Society of Western Artists, and with an eye toward trying to be in Indiana geographically diverse, and of course diverse in other ways with the mediums and the people involved. And so we also have a contemporary gallery. And the criteria for that, for those artists, also included their stories. In other words, how they are making it in the Midwest, or how they're able to live here and do their work and still thrive. Of course, with the recent economic times, that's even more difficult than it was when I was first interviewing the artists.
Absolutely. Now, not all of the artists are from here necessarily. Some of them have moved here, right?
That's correct. I wanted to have artists who actually live here and have made their names here, in addition to a lot of them are actual Hoosiers.
Was it, I know you've, because of your job, you are aware of practicing artists, of you know, working artists already, but did it still surprise you a little bit when you came up with a short list and had to pare it down with whom you might include in this exhibition?
The surprising thing is how much talent there is in Indiana and how it would have been fun to include a lot more people. But perhaps in another exhibit.
Part two down the road.
Yeah.
Maybe
one of my faults is I almost fall in love with almost every artist that I get involved with because I have so much admiration for their courage. The lives they have chosen, on one hand, seem really idyllic, and they get to choose their day and how they manage their time, but it's a very, very, very rough road.
Did they show you the other part, the other side of the coin, where they're fretting on how they're going to make the mortgage payment or the rent payment or eat next week?
Sometimes? Yes, and a lot of them actually have to do other things. In addition, sometimes they'll do full-time art and then have a job for a while. Sometimes they'll actually work part-time. Of course, there are people who work in academia who, just through sheer will, are able to do their own artwork in their quote-unquote spare time. It takes a tremendous amount of discipline. And then there are other artists, of course, who adjust their living styles to be able to accommodate their career choice.
Are any of the stories of the contemporary artists, do they remind you of any of the stories of the T.C. Steele era? Any similar trade-offs, or was it easier to make art and be in Indiana a century or so ago?
That's an interesting question. I think certainly in the case of T.C. Steele, everyone thinks of him as a landscape artist, which of course he was, but he really, his bread and butter was from painting portraits. And so he would have had to deal with the same, accommodating, different clientele and, getting along with people in the same way that everyone has to when they're working for other people.
Sure.
But in some ways, the one thing that really did, I'm kind of digressing, but that did really surprise me about the Society of Western Artists, who had an annual exhibit that traveled to all of the cities, the main cities involved, was the dedication of the artists themselves in getting things packed, and of course all the paintings just traveled by train. So, and the dedication also of the museum directors who had the shows every year, and it just seemed so much simpler without the insurance problems and packing and crating and condition reports and all of the things that we go through.
All the
now.
Bureaucracy.
Exactly.
Yeah. Huh? Is there anything, I know there are a lot of art associations and a lot of artists affiliate through one thing or another, sometimes a website like Smaller Indiana or through having studio space at the Stutz and being part of the Stutz Artists Association. Is there anything comparable to the Society of Western Artists? Is there anything that big that encompasses the majority of, or at least a dense population of our contemporary artists?
I'm not certain there is. There is an online organization of artists who do an online exhibit that, of course, is on the World Wide Web, and mm-hmm. then they have bricks and mortar venues. Where they also show their work. I'm not positive of the accurate website mm-hmm. information, or I would give that to you. But the contemporary artists are so disparate. I mean, there are the T.C. Steele and the Hoosier Group guys were all doing the same type of art, and at the time, as I said, it was cutting edge. They were doing American Impressionism, but a lot of people felt that it was going to be the next big American. It was going to be the American type of work that would be done and would be representational of America. I mean, it was kind of pre-regionalism, but mm-hmm. it was something that was seen almost as a movement. Whereas now, and that's one of the things that's really obvious in the contemporary gallery, there's just, I mean, there's still people who are doing what I'm calling neo-impressionism, but there are all kinds of different types of artwork being done. And I think in a way that speaks to our society today, that there really isn't a strong, dominant movement of art that's happening. You can do anything you want to do. If you want to do representational work, that's fine. If you want to do abstract expressionism, but there isn't any real movement going in one direction that anyone can put their finger on, even with the New York museums, the biennial and all those. It's just it's all over the place.
Real multiplicity of,
exactly.
of movements.
There are, of course, with the new media, there's a lot of new types of artwork, including video art and installations that I guess one would call more cutting edge. But as far as the quality of that work, I don't think that all of it is top quality.
Do you sometimes wish you could get into a time machine and travel forward 50 years and look back to see what lasted?
That would be a nice thing to be able to do, because of course when you're a curator at a museum, you're trying to develop a collection that's going to be significant and treasured by the public for many, many years to come, and so you are actually trying to predict what pieces will be significant in the future.
Sharon Gamble with Rachel Perry. Her new books are T.C. Steele and Society of Western Artists, 1896 to 1914, and Making It in the Midwest, Artists Who Chose to Stay. The exhibit Making It in the Midwest, Artists Who Chose to Stay is on view at the Indiana State Museum through October 18th. It explores the struggles of artists living in Indiana and the Midwest to establish reputations and careers of national and international standing. Making It in the Midwest is the first major exhibition to explore the challenges facing working artists in the Midwest and brings together an important array of historical works, many of which are in private collections and have not been seen publicly for decades. For more information, visit in.gov/ism for Indiana State Museum.
Hey, Travis.
Yes, Sherry.
How's your summer going so far?
I love summer. It's going great, you know. Outdoor fairs and festivals and fishing and movies outside and more fishing and the top down and did I mention fishing?
Careful, I'll get you to tell the story about dangling the 15-inch fish over your wife while she slept at the cabin.
I don't make these things up, nor do you. But
we're only a week into summer, and there's so much more to it.
There is so much more to do, and we'll talk about it all on
What Do We Do? Our That's calendar right. thing.
Yeah, so if you're looking for some fun arts events to do with your family, if you want to get outside, I've got a great one for this weekend. Sunday, the 28th, up at the Village of West Clay, it's their annual ice cream social. In fact,
Yum.
It's the sixth time they've done this, and it includes, of course, lots of ice cream, but there's also a bike and cart parade for the kids. The neatest thing, though, about this, I think, is their very popular sidewalk chalk contest.
Love that.
Yeah, it's really a fun event, and it's for kids. And you don't have to be a resident of West Clay. So residents, non-residents, 12 years of age and younger, can participate in this sidewalk chalk contest being sponsored by the Art and Texture Art Studio. And so all the roads along the perimeter of West Clay will be closed off, and contestants will be provided with chalk and 30 minutes to create their own sidewalk masterpiece with lots of prizes awarded. So,
wow.
You don't have to even pre-register. You just have to get up there. But you do need to get up there sometime between 1:30 and 5 p.m. on Sunday at the Village of West Clay.
Well, you know, I don't know about you, but I actually carry sidewalk chalk in the trunk of my car.
Wherever you go, just in case?
Yeah, just in case. You never know.
That's pretty cool.
Well, you know, it's come in surprisingly handy.
I carry a kite in the back of my car just in
case.
Oh,
that's smart.
It comes in handy sometimes, but I bet not as handy as sidewalk
chalk. I wonder what do you, our lovely listeners, carry in your car just in case? Send us an email.
Umbrellas don't count.
Art of the Matter at WFYI.org. It has to be something sort of artistic or playful. Well, you know, Broadway United Methodist Church is finishing up its concert series and season with an Independence Day celebration. Why am I telling you that? Because it's not on Independence Day. In fact, it's this coming Sunday at noon. There'll be a pitch-in luncheon at 12 noon on the East Lawn of Broadway United Methodist, followed by a concert at 1:30 in the sanctuary that features, get this, a sing-along of patriotic hymns, choral, brass, and organ music. So how cool is that? That's this Sunday, June 28th, at noon. Independence Day celebration at Broadway United Methodist Church.
Hey, if you're a fan of the band Dog Talk, a lot of people are, there's a new group in town that features some of those guys that we're part of, including Michael Beck and Kenny Kipp, and they're going to be playing up at the Carmel Fest on July 4th with their new band, which is called Tides. A great name for
Tides.
A summer band, I think,
love
as
that.
Well. Yeah, so and we'll be taking a look at Tides in the next couple weeks as well, but check them out, Carmel Fest, July 4th.
Excellent.
July 4th, that's coming up so soon.
It's coming up very soon. It'll be here before you know it. Get your sparklers ready. more than 130 Native American artists are gathering at the Eideljorg Museum this weekend on Saturday from noon to 5, 10 to 5, and Sunday from 10 to 5 as well. They'll be in and around Military Park, and they will be selling their wares and demonstrating their artwork, all sorts of media. It's a marketplace. It's a festival. There'll be storytellers, dancers, bands. You can try unusual foods, including the crowd favorite, Indian tacos. And there are also activities for little ones, children, in the Dog Bane activity tent, ranging from, dogs are the theme here, ranging from matchmaking to corn cob dart tossing. Woo. But seriously, if you need a gift for somebody with an upcoming event like Sharon's birthday, which is Sunday, June 28th, the Eideljorg Museum Indian Market and Festival might be the right place to look. So Saturday and Sunday from 10 to 5.
Happy birthday, Sharon.
Thank you.
In advance.
Thanks.
Another 4th of July activity is going on down in Fountain Square, being put on by the Fountain Square Arts Council, and it is their community event where they have a big parade traveling through Fountain Square and Fletcher Place. It's kind of a really neat parade because it all the parade is basically featuring one-of-a-kind artwork, and they have lots of different people who are creating the work for this parade, showcasing contemporary artworks of all sizes and shapes, dealing with parades and street pageantry and community celebration, and it's all taking place down at Fountain Square on Saturday, July 4th at 6 p.m., and when the parade is finished, there's going to be some live music and all types of, you know, neighborhood fun, and what a great place to watch the fireworks from downtown at Fountain Square.
Absolutely. If you feel like getting out of town, there's a one-tank trip for you. The annual Brown County Studio and Garden Tour is taking place all this weekend through Sunday. You have a chance to drive the winding back roads of Brown County, but also to stop in more than 20 artist studios. The doors will be open. The gardens will be open. You can see and talk with artists. Of course, purchase works if you care to. But what a lovely little road trip, and get to see a very different kind of geography. If you are used to the city of Indianapolis, get out of town. Go to Brown County this weekend.
Absolutely. And put your cup down of your car. Of your car.
Be careful.
Yeah. Hey, it's not too early to mark your calendars now for the 2009 Indianapolis International Film Festival, 10 days of innovative, adventurous films from July 15th through the 25th at the Indianapolis Museum of Art, in other words, the Toby. And this year, it includes all sorts of full-length and short subject documentaries, comedies, dramas, animated films, and all very, very cool from around the world.
Mm-hmm.
So more information is available at the IndieFilmFest.org website for the 6th annual event.
Very good. Hey, on
Oncology on Canvas is an annual art exhibition, and it's on display right now, just opened recently. It's on display at the Wellness Community Center for Cancer Support in Indianapolis, and that is up on the northwest side at 5150 West 71st Street. The exhibition is just what you might expect it to be based on its title. It is a biennial art competition that invites people from the U.S. and Puerto Rico diagnosed with any type of cancer, as well as their families, friends, and caregivers, and healthcare providers as well, to express through art and narrative the life-affirming changes that give the cancer journey meaning. So very, very cool, extraordinarily moving and meaningful art exhibit. Oncology on Canvas, you can see it at the Wellness Center, 5150 West 71st Street through July 24th.
Hey, Sharon, if our listeners are listening to our show on Friday night, then they can plan for this for tomorrow. But if you're listening on Saturday afternoon, because, you know, Art of the Matter is heard Fridays at 8, Saturdays at 4, if you're listening Saturday, you can actually still get to the Phoenix Theater's 14th Annual Brouhaha, which is going on Saturday afternoon from 3 o'clock until 7 p.m. So it is still possible to get down to the 700 block of North Park Avenue and get your tickets, your day of tickets, and sample all types of great microbrews from really all around the area.
Very good.
Yeah.
Speaking of Saturday, you drive carefully if you've been to the Brouhaha and head out for this event, but Travis, you're going to help me justify the Indians versus Toledo Mud Hens game.
Love the Mud Hens.
Saturday night at 7 as an arts event.
The Indians. Well, because it's...
Because there's a great art museum in Toledo and there, a great art museum here.
There you go. That's a great connection.
How's that? Does that work for you?
And you know what? And I can only say after just recently visiting Buffalo and watching our Indianapolis Indians play the Buffalo Bisons.
How'd we do?
At 10-2, the Indians won. After seeing that baseball park, I can safely say that the Indians park in comparison is a work of art.
Wow. Oh, thank you so much.
There you go. There is your... And I won't say anything about Buffalo.
They're out of earshot.
Yeah.
So, well, you know what? I have lots more things here in my stack of things that are coming up, but I fear we are out of time.
We are, but we will be back next week for an Independence Day celebration of
What Do We Do?
You're listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Indianapolis and Central Indiana. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. If your arts organization has an event or activity of which you think we should be aware, please contact us at least 3 weeks in advance. You can write us at The Art of the Matter, care of WFYI, 1630 North Meridian Street, Indianapolis, Indiana, 46202. Or you can email us at artofthematter@wfyi.org. You can also hear The Art of the Matter on WFYI.org.
Sees sculpture everywhere, even in the most unexpected objects. If you've never looked at a birthday candle, a ball of yarn, or a stick of deodorant and seen charming characters with personalities, well, stay tuned for Sharon Gamble's conversation with Terry Border about his obsession with bent objects.
Okay, when you were a little kid, did you ever think you were going to be manipulating, say, pieces of fruit and paper clips into art objects?
Never. It was not my idea at all. But I always was a big fan of Alexander Calder.
Really?
You know, if you are familiar with his work, most people are. He does
right.
The Mobile. And his early work was mainly in wire. Mm-hmm. He did a lot of sculptural stuff, really fun stuff. And as I grew older, I found an old roll of wire that used to be my grandfather's. And after he passed, I took a bunch of his stuff home. And one day I got this roll of wire out. And for no particular reason, I started bending it, writing with it. And
writing with it?
Writing. Well, it was Christmas time. Uh-huh. And I made some, we were wrapping up presents for my nieces and nephews. And my wife said, well, could you make some labels for these? And instead of picking up a piece of paper like a normal person, I had this wire in front of me. So I just like, well, I wonder if I can write their names with this wire. And then I just, we attached it to the presents, and they really loved it. And that was the start of it, I guess.
That's cool. A very modest start. Go back to Calder for a second. How did you get exposed to Calder's work?
You know, back in the 70s, there were a lot of those mobiles for sale. It was, they weren't his, but there were like, shiny, chromey-looking birds, you know, that you would hang.
Right,
and,
right.
And,
sort of the Marimekko era for
exactly.
People who remember that. Yeah.
Yes, and they were very popular, and I had some. And I think that was my first introduction to mobiles and that kind of thing. And so then I came across his work at some point, I'm not sure where, and maybe in an art book, school art book or something. And I just loved it. It's so whimsical and playful. And yet he is just, he was a genius at just showing something with the most minimal amount of material. And I just loved it.
And you appreciate the material because the form tends to be simple and pure.
Yes.
So if it's a disc of red metal, you really, you know, you can appreciate, oh, that's pure and beautiful and shiny, and I love it.
Yeah, and his favorite color was red, and that's what I just love going through a contemporary art museum or a modern section of an art museum and finding a mobile of his or a sculpture of his. And a lot of times it's moving. People are walking around it, and I just love it.
Anybody else in your family artistic?
My wife is a computer graphics person, and she's the real breadwinner in the arts of our house. And
and she works for WFYI.
Yes.
Anybody who's listening to this and watches TV20 has seen her work over and over again.
She does a great job.
Yeah.
And my brother is a landscape architect out in L.A. And besides that, I think that's it.
Well, that's a lot to draw from. You're surrounded.
Yes, yes. And I can show my work to those people in my family. And, you know, I trust their feedback right away. And it's helped a lot.
So this wire that was your grandfather's, what was it used for? Was it baling wire?
It was like a baling wire. It was some black-coated stuff, anodized wire of some sort, and I don't know. But it's just wire is wire when it gets down to it. I get most of my wire supplies from just big hardware stores.
So
and it's
fairly
very
small
cheap.
Gauge.
Yeah, yeah. Everything's from 26 to 9 gauge, but most of my stuff is like an 18-20 gauge wire. Easy to bend with pliers. Anybody that wanted to try it, you know, you probably have pliers in your tool shed or your garage. For $3, you can buy some wire to play around with, and it's a lot of fun.
Easy to bend, but firm enough to hold its shape.
Yes, exactly.
So a few Christmases ago, you started with writing nieces and nephews' names in the wire. And what was the next step? Did you say, oh, this is cool, I need to do this every year, or how did you start adding on corks and bananas and apples and staplers and?
Well, for a long time, I did. I was doing some. I started making 3D. Sculpture with a wire, kind of like drawing with wire, but then you're drawing in three dimensions. And the things got bigger and bigger.
Hmm.
And I followed Calder, the man, the genius, and because I always loved mobiles. I tried to get into mobiles, and I had some success. And then after a while, though, I had a lot of mobiles around our house that I hadn't sold. I sold a few.
Mm-hmm.
And so I thought, well, you know, I think I'm going to be smart about this. I'm going to start working small again. And that way, if I don't sell it, I won't have to walk around it in our house or bump my head.
You can put it in a drawer.
Yes.
If it makes you guilty.
Exactly. So I made this. I was invited to a show, and I made some small wire sculptures. And they went over really well. But, you know, I always thought with a thin wire, it's easy to walk past it. Maybe it doesn't have a mass to it.
Right. It's almost invisible.
Right.
If your eye doesn't catch the edge of it and see a shape there,
right,
you can walk past it too easily.
You'd really need a neutral background to mm-hmm. see it well. So I thought, well, what if I put some kind of object into the wire? And which is not an original thought, again, because Calder did this too. But what I think what may be original about my work is I try to play around with the our idea of the object that I'm incorporating into the wire, instead of it just being something for mass like a rock or a piece of wood. I use a like a piece of fruit or whatever, and play off our ideas of a banana and what it is.
Mm-hmm. And play is exactly the right word. And what I like about your piece is it's so hard to do this justice on a radio program because we don't have the visual here, but there are often puns or clever turns of phrase that make you think of that everyday object in a new way, which, of course, is reflected in the life of the book, The Secret Life of Everyday Objects. And it makes us think, well, what is that staple remover doing when I'm not at my desk? Maybe it has a life of its own.
Well, it's funny. You know, puns get really, you know, it's the lowliest form of humor, people say. But people love it in my work, and thank goodness. But it's a lot of fun, you know, but... one idea with the banana was, you know, bananas, you obviously peel bananas. And when I was a kid, we had a natural history book, and it showed a caveman sneaking up on a herd of elk or buffalo.
Mm-hmm.
And in this particular book, they had an illustration of the guy, and he has a skin of the elk overhanging. You know, he's holding it over his body. He's hiding. He's...
Mm-hmm.
So supposedly these elk can't tell that the hunter is not, you know, one of them.
Yeah, and their sense of smell is turned off on that day.
It's hard to even believe for me that the elk are this stupid. But I guess maybe it works. I don't know. But I thought, well, what if an orange? Let's do an orange representing the caveman, and maybe he has a banana peel hanging over his body. He's holding it with a spear in one hand and the banana peel in the other, and he's sneaking up on a herd of bananas, you know? And so what I do is I get wire to finish out my idea. I make wire legs for the banana, make it look like it's a four-legged animal, and give the orange some legs and make a little spear out of a wooden dowel put a banana peel on there. Then I had a background in photography, so I'm able to light it a little bit, and I can convey this thought I had of the funny idea of a guy sneaking up on somebody with a skin on him, and it's a banana skin.
Do you remember the first piece when you moved into incorporating items or articles beyond wire? Do you remember the first piece, your
yes.
first experiment? What was that?
It was a paintbrush bug. I got a paintbrush, like the end of the metal, when the bristles, the working end, and I clipped that off of an old, you know, I took the handle off or the wooden part
mm-hmm.
off, of, and I wrapped it with some wire, gave it some metal wings and some metal legs and some metal eyes, and I did the same thing with a little pencil. You know how a sharpened pencil looks like maybe the working end of a wasp or bee or something. So I had, the pencil was very short, you know, we had used it a lot, and give it a real sharp point, and then I gave it some wire legs and some wire wings, and people saw it, and it was just a really big hit, you know. I showed it to some people on an art forum that I go to, and they were like, oh, yeah, I want one, and from then on, I knew that incorporating an object in wire maybe gives it some more dimension than just the wire sculpture in itself.
Yeah, this may sound like a strange comment, but your sculptures are very friendly. They're
yes.
very accessible. They're very fun, but they're also kind of, they're like pets. like I have the sense of people responding to them going, oh, I want to keep that on my windowsill or on my desk or on top of my fridge or whatever. And I don't mean that as an insult in any way,
hey,
shape, or form. But
it,
there's
no.
Something about it that's just very, very friendly.
Yes, and I'm not smart enough to tell you why that is.
Maybe you don't need to. Just keep doing it.
It is. People really think they're cute a lot of times, and cute is not a word that I really love. But that, they like it, and that's all I care about. And it can show it's a good way to connect with people.
Is it true that you sometimes leave your sculptures in public places for people to discover?
Yeah, and that's...
How'd that start?
When we go on vacation... A lot of times we'll be driving someplace in the Midwest, St. Louis, Chicago, or whatever, and we'll do shifts of driving. And so I take my wire with me, and we'll go to the hotel, and I'll get the stuff they give. You know, what do they call those things? You know, they leave in the bathroom.
Oh, like little toiletry packets
and all
yeah.
that stuff. Yeah, and I make characters out of those. And put little wire arms and legs, and maybe strike them in an interesting pose. It just gives me something to do while we're in the car. Basically, I need something to do while I'm in the car traveling when my wife is driving. So I make these things, and we'll stop someplace, museum or whatever, and I just sit them someplace, and it's fun for me to think of somebody finding them. And maybe they'll treasure them when they find it. Maybe they'll think it's neat. Maybe they'll just throw it away. But that's part of it for me. For me, it's just the thought of leaving something for someone to find. There's a possibility that they'll really enjoy it, and that's cool for me. If somebody finds it and throws it away, that's fine for me too, because my part in it is over.
But somebody might find it and give it to somebody who gives it to someone, and years from now it might end up back in your path somehow.
Well, maybe. And
that would be very cool.
The thought of it, I mean, a lot of my followers on my blog, they always say, oh, I'd love to find one. And I always think it would be really neat if somebody who knows my work and likes my work found it, it would probably make their day. And up to this point, though.
Hasn't happened yet.
I have not heard from one. Which is fine.
Do you leave something with them so they would know how to contact you?
I used to. I used to send a little card with it. But I thought that was too easy for some reason. I think I like the more random thought of not knowing. And if people don't know my work, there'd be no way for them to know that I did it. And
just a gift from the universe somehow.
It's just something I'm putting out there for them.
Sharon Gamble with sculptor Terry Border. Terry's book, Bent Objects, The Secret Life of Everyday Things, will be published in October, but you can pre-order it now through Amazon.com. It will also be available at Barnes & Noble and through independent bookstores everywhere. You don't have to wait until October, though, to see Terry's whimsical creations. Go to terryborder.com, that's TerryBorder.com, to read his blog and enjoy lots of photos of his bent objects.
Thanks for joining us today. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Buscelli Wallerab Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com. Please listen to The Art of the Matter again next Friday at 8 and Saturday at 4. I'll take a look at the Keynotes duet.
And I'll be previewing the upcoming Indiana Black Expo, plus I get to find out what's going on at Garfield Park this summer. And, of course, we'll have our arts calendar that we call
What'll We Do? So please listen next Friday at 8 and Saturday at 4 for The Art of the Matter here on WFYI for your information.
You've been listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Indianapolis and Central Indiana. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. Today's Art of the Matter was produced and edited by Travis DiNicola. The Art of the Matter is made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you and by grants from the Arts Council of Indianapolis and from the City of Indianapolis and by support from the Central Indiana Community Foundation, the Indiana Arts Commission, a state agency, and by the National Endowment for the Arts, a federal agency. The Art of the Matter on 90.1 FM, Indianapolis.